Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here on a nasty day like today across a good share, I think almost all of Wisconsin, with snow and everything else, cold temperatures. We might not be thinking too much about mosquitoes or other bugs, but you know what? I'm looking at our phone lines and they're already filled. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest today to talk with us about the world of insects. And certainly, again, if you'd like to join in, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. We would love to have you. And Phil, welcome back.
Nice to be back.
We had a story. NPR did a story, and I wanted to get this out before I forget about it, about repelling bugs with the essence of grapefruit. And you had a chance to see that story. It's about a new insect repellent.
You know, people have been looking at natural plant compounds both for repellency and insecticidal activity for decades. And this product is related to some citrus-based products that are already in use. There's the linanol and whatnot that you can use as a contact kill. What makes this product really quite unique is it has both repellency and insecticidal properties. And people confuse that sometimes. I mean, repellent keeps them away. It doesn't kill them, whereas something that's an insecticide will kill them outright. And so this is derived both from a type of yellow cedar that grows in Alaska and also from grapefruit. It's an acetone that is quite active. Unfortunately, it's quite expensive to produce, and that's part of what they're toying with. Mm-hmm. The natural alcohol of this compound seems to be quite frequent, and as I said, so the chemists may be able to help us get through. But a very interesting product. And there are other ones. If people have looked now, rather than just the DEET being out there, we've got, eucalyptus oil and soybean oil and other natural products that have repellencies. The difference in these products is how long they last in your skin in many cases in like. But for short-term effect, all these things are very effective.
Well, it's good to know. And we've had some questions about, before we go to the phones here, tent caterpillars. And I wanted to bring that up with you, too, because one of our Facebook writers said, can you give me some information about tent caterpillars and what to do about them? And we have talked about them on the show.
Yeah, well, what's interesting with this weather now is depending where you are, this may be the death throw for any tent caterpillars that were foolish enough to hatch. The egg hatch is typically coincides with bud break on wild fruit trees, cherries and the like. And so it kind of depends where you are. I'm a little suspicious we're probably a week early, but it's been my experience that when you get egg hatch and then you get this kind of snowfall and whatnot, you just wipe them out. Whereas if you get a dry spring, when we get a nice spring and everything warms up quick, that tends to be the years they do better in. So if your trees have not, if you've got a crabapple in the front of the house that hasn't leafed out yet, if you go out there and look very carefully, you can see the egg masses. They're usually about 3/4 inch long. They encircle the twigs that are about the size of your finger or smaller. They're black and somewhat shiny. If you scrape that off, you're taking a tent right there.
Yeah.
Another option is once they do start to leaf out in the next week or so, the tents are very small and you can crush them with your hand. Or they're very easy to deal with. I think the mistake people is they just aren't thinking about this. And then all of a sudden they look out there and there's 4 basketball-sized tents in their crabapple tree. And the interesting thing about it is it's cosmetic. I mean, even if they strip the tree will leaf out again. And so I think in some cases I find people overreact. I know people I've talked to have cut trees down. They have taken flamethrowers out there and trying to burn them out. And I always fear that the fire will do more damage to the tree tissue than anything that the insect could do. So so now's the time to look. The next week or two, and as I said, it may just be if they did hatch, this kind of weather really gets them in big trouble.
Well, we have lots of callers, so let's go to the phones and take Jill first in Mount Horeb. Jill, hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. In those few brief, wonderful days we had last week, I was out walking in this woods behind our house, which we can only get into at this time of year because the underbrush gets bad later. And I wasn't surprised to see mosquitoes back there. But what I was unhappily surprised about was that evening on my arm, I have what certainly look like chigger bites. And I had no idea they would be out this early. Is this unusual?
Well, I get nervous if it's dry and above 50 degrees, and if you're in the right spot, you can run into them. So considering we did have a couple nice days of weather, it's definitely very, very possible. I saw my first deer tick almost a month ago now, and and the like. So we did have some good conditions. This will shut them down for quite some time. You know, they don't do well when it's wet. And I think your comment about the thick brush, I mean, that's where I tend to go find chiggers, is in you know, raspberry thickets, that kind of stuff. That seems to be a place they do quite well in.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's go on to Rich in Slinger, Wisconsin. Hi, Rich.
Oh.
What can we do for you?
I have trouble with plum curculios that wiping out my fruit crop.
Okay. How many trees do you have?
I've just got a few trees.
Okay.
They wipe out my apricots, apples, and pears.
Okay. It is probably the most difficult insect that we have for the homeowner to wrestle with because, first of all, it's not quite as predictable. The big problem with most of our fruits is the curculios, which is a type of weevil, comes on and starts to feed on the very young developing fruit. And they feed into the fruit, which causes a blemish. They also turn around and lay an egg in it. And in both cases, that fruit is not going to develop properly. And so it's a real short window. And the tough thing is that in some years it can vary by 10 days or more. And so your timing can be just right
off.
On 1 year and then just off the next. And all of a sudden you get poor results. But the critical time to try to slow them down is when the petals fall off the plant. And we spray the plant usually when there's about 80 to 90% of the petals off. And then there's usually a follow-up spray 10 to 14 days later. And those are the most critical for stopping them. Now, what makes curculio a little bit of a stinker is that they can breed out in woods and other areas, and they literally come crawling into your or flying into your trees. And so it's not as if you can do anything on your property per se to guarantee there won't be any there. So what are you using for sprays right now?
I've been using a systemic spray from... I also heard that you're supposed to put nematodes that they'll kill the larva in the ground.
Well, there's a partial truth to that, but what happens is the way they develop is that if the larvae are on the fruit, they cause the fruit to drop early, and then the curculio comes out of the fruit and burrows in the ground. And so that's where the nematodes would be potentially useful. I'll be honest, though, just picking up the windfalls, the early drop fruit, and getting it out of there is as effective, if not more effective. So I think that would be a way to go. But again, the one thing about this is that you could do everything perfect, prevent anything from breeding on what's on your fruit, but you always have this migration in. And so, as I said, I go back to the point of understanding it's an early application to try to keep them out that's going to basically win or lose the war for you.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Rich. Diane in Pulaski has a question for you, Phil. Let's go to Diane. Hi, Diane.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Phil. I have the big, large black ants in my house, and they've been there since, like, January, and I've tried the taro ant killer, but they're still around.
Yeah, you've got carpenter ants, and I know they're nesting in the house because of them being this active. In fact, it also sounds like the nest is away from an outside wall because it was outdoors, or in an outside wall, it would be too cold.
Okay.
So if you can find the nest, it doesn't take much. But if you can't find the nest, baiting is a great strategy, but taro won't do it. These really require some specialized baits, and unfortunately, you cannot get those at the local hardware store or big box store. You have to go on the internet, and what you would go to is look for specific carpenter ant baits. There's one that's called Advanced Carpenter Ant Bait. There's another one that's called Max Force Carpenter Ant Bait, and these are formulated so that the ants get real excited about feeding on them. It's not hard to get poisons that work on carpenter ants. What's hard to do is get bait acceptance. But another option right now is to try to be a detective here and watch if there's any sign of activity. I expect the ants in the kitchen because that's where the food and water will be. But if you see any other pattern of the ants always disappearing underneath, you know, the bedroom window sill, that would tell me that's where the nest is. And then, you know, a couple squirts of ant spray will take care of it. So the best approach is always to find the nest and treat it. The bait is kind of the backup technology. I will tell you it's better to bait them in the spring, so you've got some time to work with here. But with bait, you also have to be patient. Sometimes it takes 2 or 3 weeks to really kick in. So keep your eyes open. If you've had any place that's had water damage, that's a place to look for activity. Weathered wood, styrofoam, those kind of soft substrates are where the ants like to be.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. And let's move on to Lori in Saner. Hi, Lori.
Hi, Larry and Phil. Glad to hear you guys on the show again today.
Well, great to have you call.
I have questions about ticks, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been reading up on their life cycle, the ticks, and I'm trying to understand the whole stages of their life cycles. So I kind of have three questions. It sounds like in order them to move from stage one to stage two, they have to have a blood meal.
Yes.
And what happens to them if they don't get a blood meal? Do they just kind of hang around for months until they do?
The thing you have to admire about ticks is that most of our tick species here have a two-year life cycle, and they only feed three times.
Uh-huh.
And so they're extremely patient, and they're also extremely efficient at burning their energy at low levels. And so, yes, I mean, eventually they will die if they don't get a meal. But to last for weeks on end waiting for a mouse or something to come by, that's just what life is like for a tick. So, yes, they will last for at least a couple months between blood meals, waiting for the next meal to come by.
So that's kind of why they disappear in July?
Well, it depends on the species. With the what most of us who grew up in Wisconsin call a wood tick, which is mm-hmm. officially the American dog tick, it's only the adult ticks that feed on large mammals and people. And so their activity pattern is the spring till about the 1st of July. With deer ticks, they have a life stage that's active at every time of the year from the 1st of March to the end of November. And in July, it's the very small stages that are feeding, the nymphs in particular, which is the middle stage. And that's the one that's hardest to detect. And honestly, when we look at Lyme disease cases in people, we find that the highest incidence are ones that are picked up in the middle of the summer because, again, you overlook the ticks.
Yeah.
The adult tick season for deer ticks is spring and fall. In fact, the adults in the fall don't show up till about the 15th of October, which makes me believe it's somewhat day-length induced, among other things.
All right. Well, I've been waiting to ask this question for a long time. So when we have our 6 inches of snow again in a few days, do they just kind of fall asleep for a while and lower their energy level, and they're going to be right back there the following day?
Yeah, they just kind of go dormant, and the cold definitely won't stop them. They're well acclimated for those kind of things. And so, as I said, I'd seen deer ticks a good month ago in a nice warm day. And this week when it's wet, they don't do well when it's wet. They don't do well when it's cold. So I usually think about 45 degrees is kind of the cutoff when I'm walking outdoors that I have to be somewhat concerned about.
Okay, because I'm going back out into the woods again today to work. All right, thanks a lot.
All right, thanks a lot for calling, Lori. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Erica Janik, our on-air producer. Judith Sears-Poisson, engineering today, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist. Phil, we were just talking about ticks, and we got an email from Mike who said one big reason for the increase in deer ticks, according to an old-timer he talked to, at least regular ticks, is that people don't burn their fields like they used to years ago. Any credence to this comment?
Well, you know, there was a study done a number of years ago out east looking at the effect of burning prairies and whatnot on deer tick populations. And the short-term effect is it did cause them to decrease, but interesting enough, in a relatively short period of time, the numbers increased. And what they related that to is the rodent populations did better in those new burned areas. And when the rodent populations did better, the tick populations did better.
Oh.
So I think that's it. I think in the southern part of the state, I've always equated it a whole lot to the deer populations. You know, that deer were quite infrequent, you know, 50, 60 years ago around here, and now they're like rabbits, and there seems to be a very strong relationship. And the deer tick in particular is got a relatively short history. I mean, the first one was only picked up in the state back in just 1969 up in Spooner, and then we saw it distribute from there. And the interesting question is, where were they before this? And to be honest, I'm not so sure we totally understand. I use my spaceship theory when I get in these kind of dilemmas and don't have an explanation, so...
And we were talking earlier about the essence of grapefruit as a mosquito repellent, and Bill in Madison's wonders if grapefruit juice repels or kills mosquitoes.
Well, I think the active component is such a small component versus all the other things in there.
Yeah.
I would think not. As I said, that's the dilemma, that the amount is such so small, especially And there is a difference between how much you need to repel and how much you need to kill. And that's one of the problems. You really got to crank up the dosage. And because it's a very expensive product right now, this is what's slowing the development from what I can see.
And we have an email from Adam in La Crosse wondering if you've ever heard of using regular flavored Listerine antiseptic mouthwash in a spray bottle on your skin as an insect repellent. Tried that last year. I saw good results after it was allowed to dry.
Yeah, you know, this is kind of a common home remedy. In the studies I have seen that look at it, as far compared to DEET and the other products, it really doesn't hold up. It doesn't have the components. It's got alcohols and other interesting things. It's interesting if you spray a mosquito with Listerine, it's not going to make it. I mean, there are components in there that would kill it on contact, but there's no residual, nothing that if it lands on a dry surface, it probably shouldn't be affected.
Let's go to Dalton in Mosinee next. Hi, Dalton.
Hello.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I had a question. It's about last year, me and my family, we planted potatoes in our garden, and we had these little worms in them. And we were wondering if there's a way to get rid of them, or should we plant our potatoes somewhere else and if they'll come back?
Was it worms in the tubers, or were the worms eating the leaves on the potato?
No, they were in the potatoes.
Okay. What I would guess is that's a critter we call a wireworm. And a lot of this has to do with what the history of the ground is. The best way to get wireworms is to plow up an area that's grassy, so a relatively new garden. And then when you plant in it, the wireworms are already in the soil and they come up. And what's interesting about their life cycle is it can last for upwards of 4 to 7 years, which is very long for an insect. But when these worms come up, if there's no grass roots to feed on, there's things like onions or potatoes, they will drill into them and feed. So normally, once you establish a garden and you keep the grasses away, that should mean that it's not good habitat. So it's better to plant in the same ground than if you put a garden in a new area, which, again, would be inclined to have wireworms. So the more established the garden, the less likely. As I said, it's typically a problem in relatively first year and second year in particular after you work up some ground and plant into it.
Okay.
All right. There you go. Thanks, Dalton.
Well, I have one more question.
Sure.
Our dog had fleas, and we were wondering if you know any way to get rid of them.
Well, it takes two things. There are various shampoos and on-animal treatments to take care of the fleas that are on the dog to protect it. But then the fleas breed on the blood that has been processed by the adult fleas. And so depending where your dog spends a lot of time, if it has a kennel or if it has a resting area, that's likely where the fleas are breeding. And this poses a second problem. There are some very good aerosol sprays that you can get for spraying carpeting and those kind of things. They contain usually an insect hormone that prevents flea eggs from hatching and free larvae from developing. And what's neat about the hormone, it's relatively non-toxic to people. It's a very reasonable product to work with. But because it doesn't do anything for the adult fleas, they often add an insecticide to knock it down. So the combination of treating the animal and treating the bedding area of the animal is what's needed for control. I'll tell you, the other side, though, is even vacuuming every day will go a long way in knocking down the adult populations. But I still think you got to put something on the animal because that's, as I said, it's really, if you do one and not the other, you won't be successful.
There you go, Dalton. Thanks a lot for calling.
Oh, thank you.
Yep, appreciate your call. And let's go to Wanda in Middleton next. Hi, Wanda.
Hi, thank you so much. This isn't maybe kind of an unusual question. Some months ago, I saw a moth in my bedroom, and he flew behind a large dressing table, wooden dressing table, and didn't see him again. But on the bed skirt of my bed, holes were appearing and continued to appear, large holes and little holes. And I have no idea what the fabric was. It certainly wasn't wool. It was probably some kind of a polyester material for a bed skirt.
Okay. Well, it turns out that clothes moths need keratin. So they need natural products, animal hair, silk, or wool. Now, it is true that things like silverfish have been known to feed on rayon and a couple synthetics. To be honest, I don't know any insect that would feed on cotton-based things. I mean, there just isn't the kind of food there that they can be able to use. And so sometimes it's hard to sort through when you see, and the two most likely things, clothes moths make webbing and casing. So you usually see some evidence next to the holes. Carpet beetles are the other stinker. And again, they feed on wools and the like. And usually you'd see some cast skins. And so it's well worth keeping your eyes open for insects, but don't rule out that it's some kind of other deterioration. Bleach spots, not that it had to be that, but I've seen chemicals at times tend to cause, little faded areas that tend to pull out and the like. And again, if it's a synthetic compound, I'm more likely to think it was a physical nature than if it was a natural type of fabric where the insects would be more likely to be the culprit.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling, Wanda. And Steve in Madison, you're up. Hi, thank you for calling. We got Steve there?
Hello.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for calling.
Okay, hey, Phil. I was down at one of our city parks here in Madison the other day, and it's probably, the soils are really sandy, Phil, from Lake Monona. And all of a sudden, I looked down on the ground, there's thousands of these little burrows about the size of a wormhole in the sand coming out. And then I noticed all around me were thousands of these. They look like wasps or flies. And they were coming in and out of these holes. And, I mean, there were literally thousands of these little insects. And they moved so fast. I could never see one actually land. They moved so quickly. When they did land, they'd run into the hole. And I don't know if they are actually wasps or flies. Then they're a good size. They're the size of at least a good a house fly, about that size. What were those?
Well, they could be bees, too. You see in the spring a lot of what we call solitary bees. And there are solitary wasps. And a lot of them do utilize burrows in the ground. The difference would be, and the reason why I'm suspicious they're bees is because it's so early, some of the early bees are out there collecting pollen, and bees are all about pollen, and they stuff the pollen down in there, they lay their egg, and they're active for a couple weeks, and then they seem to disappear, and what's happening is their grubs are developing on their own in the ground. Wasps work the same way, but they don't collect pollen, they collect protein, usually other insects. Some collect spiders, some collect leafhoppers, all kinds of interesting critters. And why I'm suspicious about the wasp, I don't think there's enough insect activity for a wasp to be active this early. They'd have a real difficult time finding enough food to provision their burrows. And so, but I've seen the same thing in the spring. In fact, we often caution people. What's interesting about solitary bees and wasps is that there's no true nest. When I think of a nest, I think of a queen and thousands of individuals. And anything that lives in a colony like that is really quite defensive if the nest is threatened. But these solitary bees and wasps are really very docile. And I'll be honest with you, with some of the bee species, they don't even all have stingers. Plus, the males don't. And so normally, if they're in an area, even a play area in a park, you're best to just kind of let them be. And in a couple of weeks, they're gone and we don't worry about them. Now, the one thing, if you ever catch one close, bees tend to be a little bit on the fuzzy side. Bees tend to have hairs that are like a feather, that they're branched. And so that gives them a bit of a fuzzy appearance, no matter what the colors, variations are, because you can have bees that are black and yellow striped and the like. Where wasps, if you look at very closely, they have bristles on their body, but definitely not that fuzzy appearance. And so that would be the easiest way to tell the difference between the two.
Mm-hmm. So if I dig into one of these little holes in the sand, would there be a larva in there?
Well, it might be a little early, but what it would tell you, I think, is if you dug in the hole and saw it was provisioned with little pollen balls, you know it's a bee. If it was provisioned with a bunch of little paralyzed insects, then we know it would be a wasp.
There you go.
I'll send you a picture, okay?
Sounds good.
Yeah, please do.
There was just thousands of them. It was amazing. And they didn't seem like I was disturbing them at all. They were just buzzing all around me and the dog. Thanks, Phil.
Sure. Yep.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. If you get a good picture, Steve, post it on our Facebook page, too, at the Larry Mueller Show. I'd love to see that, actually. We have Mike in Coon Valley next with a question for you, Phil. Hi, Mike. Thanks for calling.
Thanks. Got a question about them pesky powder post beetles again.
Okay.
Will they burrow deeper into a board than the sapwood, and once they're in there, how long do they actually stay in a board?
Well, the length depends on the nutrition of the wood. There have been cases where powder post beetles have taken 5, 6, 7 years to emerge, which usually means the food source isn't very good. I remember one case of a gentleman who was making guitars, and he had a beautiful ash neck on the guitar, and the wood moisture content was down to 7%, which is not good at all for powder post beetles. That's too dry. And be darned, 2 years after he made the guitar, he had one beetle come out. And so, as I said, they're really quite amazing, the length of time. Typically, it's a one-year life cycle. They will tend to be more common in the sapwood, but you do see them move around. And as I said, it really, their success depends on the starch and moisture content in the given part of wood. And they will be where the moisture is somewhat higher and where the starch content is higher. That's where they're the happiest.
So once they're in a board and then they mature and leave, will new ones come back in if they're still...
Yes, that's the stinker of powder post beetles, is they continue to breed and go through numerous cycles in the same board, whereas so many of the wood borers that we get that come out of, you know, green lumber and the like are in there only once for one generation, and then by that time the lumber is changed enough physically that it's no longer suitable. It's too dry is really what it is, but powder post beetles do well down to about 11 or 12% moisture content.
There you go.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for calling, Mike. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, with your questions at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Talking insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. An email from Bernie and Valders wondering if wood ticks do better in sandy soil areas, or is it just the vegetation in the overgrown pit areas?
Yeah, sand, I mean, ticks do have a problem with desiccation and drying out. And so if it's a very harsh environment, you know, I'm thinking more of a sand barren and whatnot, I don't expect them to be real happy in that environment. They like it lusher, where it's more humid and the like. They don't like it real wet, you know, so it's kind of the in-between. So I usually think of them doing better in areas that have a little bit more moisture. But if you're in a sand area that's getting sufficient moisture, you could find ticks there. Both deer ticks and wood ticks. What I find is the habitat you find in wood ticks is quite a bit wider. Deer ticks I usually find restricted to wooded areas with a lot of underbrush and understory.
Let's go to Jennifer in Madison next. Jennifer, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have two questions about swallowtail butterflies and caterpillars.
Mm-hmm, okay.
Last fall, my daughter collected quite a few swallowtail caterpillars and also monarch caterpillars. The monarchs all hatched out, and it got cold, and the swallowtails still had not hatched out. And we read that that you could overwinter them, and we kept them on the porch in a cooler. And so I was wondering, first of all, at what point in the spring should we be expecting them to come out of their cocoons? And secondly, another family brought their cocoons inside and watched their caterpillar hatch out, and instead it was a wasp. And
that's a disappointment, yes.
Yes, and you know, and we learned a little about that, about how you know, how that happens. I was wondering, maybe you can explain to listeners how that happens, and also, is there any way we can tell by looking at the cocoon if we're going to be getting a butterfly or a wasp?
No. You could tell if you look carefully at the caterpillar, because you can either see the stinged areas where the eggs were inserted, or depending on the species, there are some that lay their eggs on the outside. So if you're lucky enough to take a close look, you can see. But once they make the chrysalis, you can't. These are various parasites, and all insects have a litany of parasites that are natural and honestly keep them from getting crazy as far as populations. What happens with swallowtails, they overwinter in the chrysalis stage. When the daylight gets short, they're just like plants. They know that the winter's coming, and they honestly will refuse to develop. Many insects that do this need to go through some kind of cold shock or extended period before they develop properly. And so one of the mistakes people make sometimes is when they bring a chrysalis or a cocoon, if it's from a moth, into the house in the fall, thinking they're doing it a favor by keeping it warm, you will not get the right conditions. So what you did by keeping it in a porch or a garage is exactly what you need to do. Once we get to now, when things warm up, it's all about how much temperature. It's kind of like baking a cake. The hotter it is, the quicker things will happen. So if you were to bring the chrysalises in the house and keep them at 70 degrees and whatnot, they're going to emerge quite a bit earlier than if you left them, you know, on the porch and go through a more natural cycle, where typically I saw my first imported cabbage worm this weekend. I've seen some morning cloaks. What's interesting about that? There, we've got some butterflies.
Where was it?
It was sitting in the Pelletieri garden, unfortunately. Ah. But you find that some species of butterflies, like morning cloaks, overwinter as adults. So I saw my first morning cloak a month ago when it was a nice day and I was out for a walk. But something like the cabbage worms, just like the swallowtails, is that they're chrysalises. My guess is if we had a 65 degrees 3 days in a row, we'd start to see them, you know. But that's what it's going to take. It's going to take some kind of extended warm-up. And I think it's best to leave it on the porch. When we finally get warm, then you can bring it in, you know, because I'm sure the kids will want to watch it emerge. That's just a real exciting thing to watch. And then when after a few hours, when the wings are fully stretched and hardened, then you can release them. And then the plants will be up enough so that they have an opportunity to mate and continue things.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, thanks, Jen, for calling. Kyle in Weyerhaeuser, you are next. Hi, Kyle.
Yeah, how you doing?
Good.
I got a question about, I split a piece of firewood, and I've been throwing a little wood in the basement with this cold we're getting, and there's some white worms that are eating in there. I don't know what they are, but I'm scared they're going to get, I don't know if there's something that'll eat up my house or what.
Sure. With all this firewood stuff, and there's all kinds of neat critters you get out of firewood, and you know some of these things will be 2 inches long and as big around as your finger, but basically they are insects that can only attack dead and dying wood and don't pose any problem to the house. Again, there's two things with your wood in the house. It's too dry for them to be happy to be in there. Secondly, a lot of it's finished. In most of these insects that are laying eggs on wood, it's got to be farm sawed. It's got to be open vessels so that they can get their eggs inside. And so anything that's painted, varnished, all those vessels are sealed, and they don't attack it. So they can make a mess. They can be a little bit noisy. And you'll see some interesting big beetles sometimes with great big long antennae that look kind of scary that come out of it. But they're really only a nuisance. And again, anything in firewood really doesn't pose anything other than that kind of problem. Once the firewood gets seasoned after a couple, 3 years, then it becomes possible breeding habitat for this powder post beetle we talked about earlier. They go after seasoned wood, and they are capable of going through, but they leave very small holes in a very fine, almost talcum powder-like sawdust. The holes are about the size of a small BB, and they're very round, and so that's the difference. If you see a lot of that kind of stuff, you don't want to bring that firewood in, but the bigger stuff I don't worry about.
Mm-hmm.
All right, then. Yeah, well, I've been leaving it outside and bringing it in just enough to throw it in the stove, so.
Yeah, well, that's fine. And, yeah, you know, I get laughed at when I tell people, because if you store a large amount of firewood in the house, there are going to be critters that come out.
Sure.
And so I tell people, you know, do just like this gentleman's doing. He's bringing it enough for, you know, a week or so or less. When I tell people up in Ashland that, they laugh at me because, of course, you know, sometimes in some areas the winter is so bad, you need to store it indoors. I understand that. But one of the artifacts of that is very interesting little critters crawling around the house in January and February. So,
thanks, Kyle. Thanks for calling. And Diane in Milwaukee, we turn to you next. Hi, Diane.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm hoping that Phil can tell me how to avoid ticks when I'm out hiking with my dog. I'm thinking in terms of, like, the time of day, the environment, the season where you're most and least likely to encounter them.
Well, you know, things have gotten with a deer tick. If there's no snow on the ground, there can be ticks out. Now, where you go has a lot to do with it because, you know, if you're in mowed areas and sitting on hiking paths and not brushing up against vegetation, the chance of getting the ticks is really quite small. It's when you're out in the longer grass and going through the brambles and the understory, the ticks are literally sitting there waiting for their prey to come by, and that's when they latch on to you. And time of day really doesn't matter. You can pick ticks up at night. They're not really active. It's more temperature that will influence them. And I use the general rule below 45 degrees. It's too cool for them to be active. They just can't move their bodies. But above 45 degrees, you got to be careful. Real wet times, they don't seem to. They lay low when it's wet. They like things somewhat dry. Although I have seen it dry enough back in 88 and 89 that the ticks got stressed out. I mean, they literally died from desiccation. So it can get dry enough to cause them trouble. But as I said, if you're in an area that there is tick activity, I would keep my guard up anytime there's no snow on the ground. And one of the options you have is the clothing sprays with permethrin in it. They sell it as a repellent, but it really isn't a caricide. It kills the ticks. And so if they walk on your jeans or pants that have been sprayed, they will not survive long enough to feed on you. And there are similar types of products for on animal.
And those sprays last more than a day.
Yeah, in fact, as long as the pants don't get wet. Yeah. So you can talk a couple weeks easily. In fact, again, in the sporting goods stores, there are clothing that this is impregnated in. So if you get into areas where there's just crazy with ticks and you just don't want to spray this stuff all the time, you can buy shirts or mm-hmm. pants that have this. This is a technology the Army came up with to protect their people when you get into ticks and mosquito areas.
Thanks again for calling, Diane. Appreciate it. We had a caller who couldn't stay online but wanted to know what to do about Asian lady beetles.
Well, at this time of the year, let them go. Because yeah. what's happening is that the ones that spent the whole winter in your house are waking up, and their behavior is to leave. And I can guarantee you they don't breed indoors. So other than vacuum them up, but it doesn't do any good to spray them now because, well, no. 2 points. It's not going to influence the population down the road. And secondly, if you spray them, you got to clean them up anyway. So just get the shop vac out and be done with it. And if they are problematic in the house, the two things to consider is one, they're coming in late September, early October. If you can figure out how they're getting in and tighten things up, that's the best solution because it's permanent. But if you've got just an older home that there's just too many places for them to crawl into, then you spray the outside of the house in that time with the various pyrethroid sprays. And it's like a window. You either treat them then or forget it, because once they get in your walls, there's just no way you can stop them for the rest of the fall, winter, and into the spring.
Bill in St. Croix Falls has a question for you, so let's go to Bill. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I've got some flying black ants that are hatching and coming up, and I want to know how to get rid of them and if they're a danger.
Okay, they middle-sized, large-sized?
I'd say middle to large, more middle, I think.
They're probably carpenter ants, and what you're seeing are the queens and the kings, and the first thing I can tell you is that those ants have been living in your house for at least 3 years, because you don't produce wing forms until the colonies get to a certain size. They are not, I've said this a number of times on the show, we shouldn't have called them carpenter ants, because people get the vision that they eat wood for a living, and they don't. They're not like termites. They nest in rotting stumps in similar environments. So what it tells me is that you've probably got some softened wood somewhere, although it doesn't have to be wood. I've seen them coming out of styrofoam. And the best thing about the wing forms is they show you where the nest is. So if they're all showing up in a corner of your bedroom, the nest is up in the ceiling. If they're showing up around a window, that's where the nest is. And that's the secret to control. You know where the nest is, you spray into it. So pay close attention where they're active. They probably aren't going to be active the next couple, 3 days because it's so cool. But then we get in a good sunny day, they're probably going to start to wake up. And this is about 6 weeks earlier than the normal swarming or wing forms, which again underlines I know they're nesting indoors.
Yeah. What do you spray them with?
Any ant spray. I mean, honestly, it's not what you use, it's where you put it. And you know what I always tell people, if you know where the nest is, it's just a spot treatment. You don't need much spray. If you don't know where the nest is, spraying is like shooting in the dark. It really is not effective. And so you're better off to sit back and hunt this down and be a good detective, because, as I said, you'll be less frustrating. You use a lot less spray and be more effective.
And then you probably need to take a look at the area, and there may need to be some repairs done.
Yeah,
there.
See, when you see damage, it's water damage. And so the ants get blamed for it. But if you continue to have water problems, that, of course, as a homeowner, the thing you have to worry about, because that's what's going to cause the damage to your wood.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You can join in our conversation today as we talk about the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri by calling us at 1-800-642-1234 or by emailing us at talk@wpr.org. And we've got open lines, so we can get you on very quickly. So give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. I had an email from Debbie, Phil, and Debbie says, I have found a few silverfish. I found one in the kitchen sink, then another in my bedroom, and then one someplace else. What are they feeding on, and how do I get rid of them?
Well, silverfish, it's quite common to see them in sinks, because what happens is they fall in and they can't get out. And so people have this concept that they're associated with water coming out of the faucets, but that's not true. And this is a common time to start seeing them because they're often living in your walls where they feed on starch-based type things. So, you know, they've been known to feed on old wallpaper glue, old books, those kind of things. And, of course, we often have insulation that's got paper backing and the like.
Sure.
And so as the walls warm up, they wake up and they're out cruising around. And honestly, I think they scare people much more than they should because I'm not saying that I haven't seen silverfish damage, but most of the time it's just their sheer presence that freaks people out. They're just kind of creepy looking to people. So a couple options. Honestly, we know environmental-wise that they do better with somewhat damper conditions. And anything you do to dry things out tends to make the habitat less favorable. They do respond to ant sprays, and so one of the options is to spray the baseboards and back in the closets where you see activity. And those sprays will last for a number of months, and so it's not like you have to spray repeatedly, and if they crawl through it. One of the interesting things, knowing that they're starch feeders, I have seen at times in various catalogs basically little sachets that are a combination of cornstarch as the food attractant and boric acid mixed in very lightly.
Kill them.
And you throw this back, and if they feed on that, they'll eat the boric acid. And that's the thing about boric acid. It's a stomach poison. So you got to get it in their tummy somehow, and that works quite well with cornstarch. And so that's kind of a home remedy. And if you go that direction, you don't need very much boric acid. We're talking like 2 or 3%. So those are options. You know, are you going to see a bunch of them? I don't think so. I rarely have seen a case where I see more than one on occasion is, I guess, what I would consider the norm.
Got an email from Jeff in Marshfield. Walking through our land with my daughter, I noticed some of our many anthills coming to life in the spring with thick masses of ants covering the crest of the hill. Well, we always wondered what type of ants these are. We have dozens of very large mounds on our 39 acres, some over 2 feet tall and 3 feet across. The mounds, that is. The ants' color goes from reddish-brown in the front to black in the back. Love to know more about these fascinating creatures.
Because of the large mounds, it's a giveaway. And we call them Formica, which is the name of the genus, but they're commonly given the name field ants. They look like carpenter ants because they tend to be middle to large in size. They're often black or black and red, depending on the species. And we have a number of the species in the state. They're fascinating because they have a single queen, and the colonies can live for 10 to 12 years, and they create these huge mounds. Some of the species are very important in prairie ecology, in recycling nutrients and aerating soil, so they're normal. But there are some species you find in the woods. They're not an ant that comes indoors for food, you know, so they're not a nuisance as far as that goes. But the one thing is, if you've ever, you know, plowed into a nest or whatnot, the ants get a little agitated, then they do bite. They can't sting, but they do bite, and that's not pleasant. So there are certain circumstances. They also don't like their nest shaded, so honestly, we have seen them. They're capable of killing plants by injecting formic acid into the roots. That's where the name Formica comes from. So I've seen them kill Christmas trees 6 feet high. I mean, it's just amazing, where they poison the roots because the Christmas tree was shading their nest. But other than that, you can make the argument they are basically predators on caterpillars, ticks, all kinds of things. And so they really are beneficial as long as they're not in your way. And the only way I see them getting in the way is, again, if you've got a mound in the middle of your lawn, the mounds get big enough you can't mow over them. So those are potentially worth treating. But to treat them, you've got to get the queen, and she's like 2 or 3 feet in the ground. And so usually I suggest you make some kind of tunnels with an old rod or dowel and punch it into the ground as much as you can, and then treat with your liquids deep in the ground to be effective. But the ones out in the prairies and woods, in fact, this is great. If you ever burn a prairie, it's mind-boggling how many nests are out there. All those little mounds you see are usually field ant nests, and you know, I've seen them at densities of 3 or 4 per square yard. So
Well, so much for those insects. Let's go to Mary in Chippewa Falls, who has a question for you, Phil. Mary, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, my daughter and son-in-law purchased a home 4 years ago, and the home had carpet. And then the carpet was taken up, and underneath were these beautiful wood floors, which the prior owners had refinished. Shortly after they moved in, it was like all these little bugs start coming out from down in the cracks of the wood. And they've had a professional service now going on 3.5 years. The critters still are there. She's calling them carpet beetles, but she won't put anything down on the floors. I mean, rugs, anything like that. And I just think that's such a long time. I'm wondering if they're misidentified or if that's what they are.
They could be carpet beetles, but the story here, I mean, carpet beetles are fascinating because they feed on animal hair, they feed on wool, they feed on dead insects. They're just terrible in insect museums. And the like. And so when people see numbers like this, I make the argument, I can find carpet beetles in anybody's house, but it's usually a couple here, a couple there, no big deal. When you find consistent big numbers, there is a consistent food source. It wouldn't be in their living space because I think they would see it, would suggest it's in the walls. And is it dead insects? Is it things like, you know, cluster flies or Asian lady beetles? I think you need to get more at the heart of it because I agree with you. If you've treated it continually for 3 years and it isn't getting any better, there's no reason to believe the continued treatments are getting directly at the problem. And so I think the next step is coming up with what these carpet beetles are feeding on and seeing if we can stop that. And if we can stop that, we solve really two problems.
What do you do? You open the walls? Look, how do you?
Well, anytime you get an opportunity, you know, if you're replacing windows, you poke around. How old is the house?
Well, they said it was built in 1964.
Uh-huh. I think it's worth looking in the attic. To be honest, I've seen carpet beetles associated with mouse bait, and if somebody's thrown too many mouse packs in the attic, that can be the problem. But as I said, I think it takes some detective work here. I'm not sure it's worth ripping a wall open, but I go back to if all they're doing is spraying the baseboards and it's not solving the problem, I don't see an advantage of continuing to spray. And you know, a lot of times that's what I see is that carpet beetles are falling through light fixtures or other places. Mm. And so, you, as I said, you got to trace back. And if they're coming from the baseboards, I don't know, maybe it's worth just pulling one of the baseboards off the wall a little bit to see if you can see any more, get a hint of what kind of food sources. Very old homes, they used to use horsehair mixed with plaster. And so that's a food source. So, you know, we're talking homes built back in 1890s and whatnot. We've seen some trouble with continuous carpet beetles associated with that. But this house sounds too new to have that kind of problem.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling, Mary. And Sunny in Nina, hello to you.
Hi there. Hey, I am curious about earwigs. I didn't encounter them until I moved to Wisconsin, and they kind of creep me out. But I'm wondering if they're any kind of a nuisance or if they're just weird-looking bugs.
If you're a marigold, they're not good. Honestly, the one thing I see they feed on is marigolds. They do some plant damage. Coming indoors is a dead end for them. They can't breathe. They don't hurt anything. But they're related to cockroaches, and they creep people out like cockroaches. And so that I think, is the problem. You know, they have these pairs of cerci, what we call them, but the little pincers on the back. That makes them look scary, but they're pretty much harmless. And you know, when people ask for suggestions to get rid of them, I always tease. But really, if you understand what I'm talking about, I tell people, make your backyard a sandbox and you won't have them, because that kind of dry environment won't support them. But if you like lush gardens and the like, that's exactly what earwigs do well under. They like things damp, dark, and they're omnivorous. They feed on insects and on plants. I made the mistake one time in a talk. I called them, they're like goats, and one of the people in the audience raised goats, and they were very much offended by my statement. So I try to be more careful with that. But as I said, a little bit of plant damage, but other than that, they're really not that serious.
All right. Thanks, Sonny. And on to Rick in Superior next. Hi, Rick.
Good morning. Yes, I'd like to know if there's any beneficial uses for the cocoons that are made by tent worms. I've noticed their strength and resilience as far as trying to remove them from different surfaces, especially wood surfaces.
You know, I would bet, and this has been looked at before, because we use silkworms, the domesticated silkworm, for making fabric. The problem with all the natural native species is we can't unwind a single piece of thread the way they're done. Either it's the glues or the way that they're glued on. And so if somebody could solve that riddle, again, you could make probably a very strong thread out of this, but I don't think people have been able to unwind that, because we've looked at our wild silkworms, we can't do it. And the same with this is I just don't think you'd get a single strand of thread that you could unwind.
There you go. Dee in Appleton, your turn. Hi, Dee.
Hi. I walk my dog in High Cliff year-round, and he never gets ticks. I brought this up to my vet, and he said he has seen that same thing in his practice. And I was wondering why you think that might be. And the only thing I could come up with is that they're very aggressive on getting rid of invasive species.
I mean, the only way we really know what kind of tick densities are there is to do a survey. And to be honest, our expensive surveying tool is either a pair of corduroy pants or an old wool blanket. And you just tie a string to it, and you walk it and drag it behind you. And the ticks latch on. Anything that's got a good nap, they latch on. And that's why the dogs are usually tick magnets. They're easier to latch on than to our clothing. So my first take is that they're just not populations there. And, you know, going back, we had talked earlier about these big mound-making ants. If you see a bunch of field ants in an area, you won't find ticks because they won't last long enough. The field ants will feed on them and carry them away. So it just may be a combination of what's in the natural environment that the ticks just aren't doing well. Chemical-wise, we know mosquitoes that, you know, there's different chemistries, but I've never heard of anybody coming up with a repellent or an animal that's naturally repellent. Although I will tell you, with cows, we know that they can develop antibodies in their blood that make life much more difficult if they've been fed on too much by ticks. So they almost become resistant to them. The ticks will still latch on, but they're not successful in completing their feeding. So
there you go. Two callers wanted to know about box elder bugs and how to get rid of them.
Well, they're like the Asian lady beetles. They're leaving right now, so let them be. The fall of the year is the time to get them. Early September is when they congregate on the sunny sides of the house. Various sprays, but and this comes from the show, soaps. But, you know, I like insecticidal soap because I know what's in there. My colleague from Iowa State used to talk about a half a cup of Tide laundry detergent to a gallon of water. And we were doing the show a number of years ago, and somebody called and said, I tried Cheer and it didn't work. The problem with soaps is you're not sure what's in there. Or if you buy the stuff that's sold as insecticidal soap, it's always the right stuff. And it's a contact spray. So if you're comfortable with it, you know, you buy some insecticidal soap and you got a cluster, you spray them, you're done.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest, and he'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So happy you're here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thank you so much for listening in as we visit with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, Larry Mueller here. Lots of calls and questions. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. Interesting email, Phil, from Todd, who says, as a trout fisherman, I've always wondered why the hex hatch is earlier on trout streams than on the Mississippi. It would seem to me they would hatch earlier in the warmer system. Are they the same species?
That would be my first question, if they are, because I, you know, these aquatic insects, it's really quite interesting. There's many more diverse species out there than most people realize until you start studying them closely, because it is, you know, insects being cold-blooded, everything is temperature related, and so one would expect that if they were the same species and it was warmer water, they'd emerge earlier.
All right. We have a call from Al in Madison. Let's go to Al. Thanks for waiting, Al. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a wood turner, and I have checked with Forest Products Laboratory, and I think I called you folks a couple of years ago. I have had a method of treating a small pieces of wood, maybe 6 inches in diameter or so, and about maybe 10 inches long, by freezing and thawing and freezing and thawing, and that killing off powder post beetles that way. I wonder if I do it on a 5-day cycle. In other words, I in the winter, I put them out, you know, in a container out on my porch and let them sit there for 5 days, and I bring them into my warm kitchen for 5 days, and then go out on the porch again for 5 days. Am I tracking right on that in terms of the kill cycle? I kill, I think my theory is I kill the live beetles, adult beetles, by freezing them and then bringing them in and allowing a hatch, and then, you know, again, freezing those, the hatchling. So I'm just wondering whether, Phil, whether I'm tracking right on that.
You are, but the tough thing to answer is what you find with insects, it's shock that kills, but it also depends what they've seen before. And so, you know, the example I would use is if you had a infested piece of wood and you left it in your garage and it went through a normal cooling process and the powder post beetles came, you know, naturally became dormant. You brought it in the house for 5 days. I'm not so sure that's enough to wake them up. and get them active. And so that's the thing is you've got to get them active and moving them and then do a drastic temperature change. If it's been working for you, it's fine. But what you might consider is two things, is leaving it in longer to get them, make sure you wake them up and get them, you know, going. So we're even talking 2 or 3 weeks. And then outside, the colder, the better. You know, and the tough thing is, you know, we think of anything below freezing. When I think of killing insects, it's at least 0 degrees, if not more, before I'm comfortable that it's cold enough. It's much like bed bugs. You know, the research is telling us that the magic number is minus 15 degrees. At minus 15 degrees, I can kill a bed bug in a matter of seconds. But above that temperature, it depends on that combination of what they've seen before, what they've been prepared for, and how long you hold it. So, as I said, I think if this has been working for you, great, you've got it down. But if I had to tweak the system, I'd leave them in longer indoors to warm them up, and then make sure you got some good cold weather to deal with when you do expose them outside.
Mm-hmm. There you go, Al. Thank you very much for calling. Jeff and Nina, on to you now. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Phil. Appreciate the call. I've had, in the last few months, we've had some small flying insects in our house, a little bit bigger than a fruit fly. I put out fruit fly traps, moth traps, and they don't seem to catch them. Could you tell me what you think that might be and what I could use to get rid of them?
Got to see the critters. Because this is one of these things that if we know what it is, I'm not so sure it's going to be a spray. It's going to be an adjustment. I don't know if they're drain flies coming or sewer flies coming out of a floor drain. I've seen, you know, it in the spring, in last fall, there's a little critter called a psyllid that comes from hackberry trees, and it comes through the screens, and, you know, it's a little gnat-like looking creature. And there, you know, there are some things you could do to the tree if you really needed to, but I really do need to see what the critter is. So you can get a couple of them, send them, you bring them in the local extension office. If they can identify them, fine. If not, they'll send them down. I mean, that's what we do in the lab is back up the local county extension offices. And once I know what it is, I think I can point you in the right direction.
Okay. One other question I've got. The ants that build mounds in your yard, what's the best thing to get rid of those?
Well, they're honestly, most of the things, I often talk about the insecticide 7 because it's readily available, but most of the garden insecticides would be effective. But the trick is to get the product down to kill the queen. And so that, depending on the size of the nest, usually anything you can use to drill down in, open up an opening so that the stuff will soak deep enough to get the queen is the secret. And that's why I like liquids, because you can mix it up in a little, you know, bucket and just pour it on. You know, anything you spray, I don't think there's enough volume to soak deep enough. And that's why we talk about a drench is really what this treatment is, where you've got the liquid and just pour it on so that it seeps down as deep as it can.
All right. There you go. Thank you very much for that call, Jeff. And Sylvia in Appleton, your turn. Hi.
Hi. I have two things quick. Since the earwigs appeared here in Appleton, I have found no monarch caterpillars, and I find the eggs on a regular basis, but the earwigs are sitting on top of the milkweed plants. And within 2 days, any eggs that are laid are gone. The other thing is I have a small wildflower garden, Monarda, New England Aster, St. John's Wort. In the last 2 years, I have had some bumblebees, type bees, that are extremely large that I've never seen before. And I usually have 4 or 5 different sizes out there. And these are almost twice as large as the normal, quote-unquote, bumblebees that I've seen before. Are these a new species for the area, or we're talking over an inch?
Okay. Well, two things. I think you're exactly right on the earwigs being predators in eating either small caterpillars or eggs. That has been documented. My comment that they're omnivorous. They eat both plants and insects material. Bumblebees, they're probably queens. I don't know of any new species of anything. In fact, we've had declines in some of our native species because of some disease problems in the last 10 years or so. And bumblebees, even in the same species, come in different sizes. The queen is always the biggest. The size of the workers depends on the nutritional status, you know, how well they've been fed as they mature and the like. And so, you know, early season, every bumblebee you see is a queen. And so you expect them to be bigger. But with those number of species, you may have a species in your area now that was not there before. So it's not a new species of the state, but it could be a new species to your area. But I said, other than that, it does get tricky because even with one species, you can see quite a variability in size.
Hmm. There you go. And speaking of bees, I just wanted to mention for people in the Madison area, there's a film, Vanishing of the Bees, will be screened April 23rd at Sundance Cinemas on Midvale Boulevard in Madison. It's part of Do Something Real Film Festival here in Madison. So Vanishing of the Bees, I don't know if you've heard about that film.
Yes, I have. Yeah. And it's, there's some very interesting things going on, different opinions of why it's going on, but I think just to appreciate that both honeybees, bumblebees, and even our native bees all have a number of issues.
So that's April 23rd at Sundance Cinemas. I want to bring that up. And someone else mentioned Forest Products Laboratory, and that reminded me as well that tomorrow we'll visit with the author of A History of the Forest Products Lab. It was written to commemorate its centennial anniversary. So that, looking forward to that as well. And we have an email from Lori in Milwaukee. What do centipedes eat? What eats centipedes?
Other centipedes. Spiders. Centipedes are predators. And so there are other things, and there isn't that many predators in the house, but as I said, I have seen them caught in spider webs, and the spiders I know have fed on in them. And you never see a lot of centipedes. We do have a species that's pretty much only found indoors. Scutigera is that, I know it is the house centipede. And that's the one that usually freaks people out because it's got the long legs and runs like crazy when you turn the lights on and the like. But again, when you think of it, if they're feeding on insects and other things, there's not much food available in a house. They're very slow to breed. We're talking months at best. And so it's one here, one there type of thing. But because they're so creepy, people have kind of a zero tolerance of them. And if you've got an older home, the chance of having house centipedes in there is probably pretty good because whether the previous resident brought them in or honestly, when you're moving, you bring them in on boxes and those kind of things and introduce them that way.
And an email from Bob, I live on the southern edge of Lake Monona and discovered glowworms in my lawn at night during early June. They're lovely at night, grub-like in the light of day. What are they?
Well, there's two types of glowworms. The ones that doesn't flash is a family related to fireflies. They're really beetles. And the females, we call them larviform, meaning they never transform into adults. And so what you're seeing are females honestly advertising their availability to males. And they're like a mood ring. They just, there's this kind of iridescent-y greenish glow or yellowish glow. And as long as they're happy, that's there. If you disturb them, it takes a matter of about 20 to 30 seconds and the color fades. That's because this is an enzyme that's getting oxidized and they have some control over it. So related to fireflies, glowworms and fireflies are really beneficial because in the larval stage, they're predators on either millipedes in the case of glowworms or slugs in the case of fireflies. Related to it, the adult is the bizarrest looking insect. If you look up male glowworm sometime, you will never think it's a beetle, but it is. It's got funny big antennae that are all feathery. It's got weird wing covers. It's a great one we use in our collections. If we ever want to see if a student really knows their beetles, you throw one of those at them because if you've never seen it before, you're probably going to guess it's not a beetle.
Dennis in Green Bay, we're on to you now. Hi, Dennis.
Okay. Every now and then, maybe it's been happening more and more, but there's a small bug that I'll pick up occasionally. There's generally no more than one when I see them. Anywhere from a quarter to three-eighths of an inch long, and they're black and white. They don't move very fast. You just kind of pick them up, they crunch, and you throw them in the garbage. What is that?
Need more information. How many legs? Does it have antennae? Does it?
No, you do not see any antennae. You can see the legs. They're very close to the floor. They're always on the floor.
Okay.
Kind of a clear kind of looking, not even white, but more of a like a beigey color. And then
okay.
I think the two ends are black.
Look on the internet for a larder, L-A-R-D-E-R beetle. Mm-hmm. I'm suspicious that's what you've got. Larder beetles are a type of carpet beetle, but they feed on very high protein food. So dead animals, a dead mouse from 2 years ago would be the carrion they feed on. They also feed on cluster flies and other protein sources. I have seen them in very greasy dog food if a bag was left somewhere. The worms are a dark brown, fuzzy, and they have these little hooks on the end, which we use to identify them. But the adults show up very often in the house, and again, they're feeding on dead lady beetles in the attic and other places. And so, people don't put the two together, and it gets very frustrating because they see just kind of this, you know, slow, constant adult beetles that are out cruising around and don't realize that, again, they're coming from the walls or the attic. So it's not really very obvious. Good news is they're harmless. But they do suggest that, again, you've got a food source around and the like. They're related, in fact, same genus, just a different species, to the beetles that taxidermists use to clean animal skulls. Because, again, that's the whole diet of these things is a high-protein food source. And the name comes from they used to be a pest of dried bacons and hams and those kinds of things.
There you go. Thanks a lot, Dennis, for calling. And Paula in Rhinelander, we turn to you now. Hi, Paula.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, every year, and it's usually about July, I get like it's like the black flies hatch, and I part of my basement is a crawl space, and I assume that's kind of where they're coming from. But I'll come home from work, and I'll have loads of them in my dining room window, kitchen window, and you know I end up sucking them up with a vacuum cleaner. Next night, same thing, and this goes on for about 2 weeks every year, and it's like I said, usually about July. And I've tried spraying around the foundation of my house outside, like with Home Defense and that, you know, kind of product. But it just, I don't know, it doesn't seem to do anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, a couple thoughts. I don't think what I call a black fly is something that would never come in your house. It bites you when you're out canoeing and that kind of thing. My first suspicion is they're winged ants in that you're getting a swarm. And so they keep swarming, you know, and swarms are usually very seasonal and very short-lived. And you never get to the nest, so you never take care of them. But what I would ask is, again, if you even give me some specimens just to make sure who we got, and then we can start looking at it. But I think this is a case of we got to find where the source is. The source must be coming out of the crawl space, and that would fit for ants. And that may be the way we have to treat it is get in the crawl space and treat the nests.
Mm-hmm. There you go. And I wanted to bring up stink bugs. These brown marmorated stink bugs have been a problem around the country, it seems, especially they go after soybean crops.
Oh, they go after fruits.
The way
I explain this insect, it is the multicolored Asian lady beetle married with the Japanese beetle. But the difference is on fruits. They're a pest of apples. They're a pest of peaches, pears, cherries. They also get on tomatoes and peppers and on soybeans. And they're from China. They have been in Pennsylvania for about 8 or 9 years. And for the first 6 or 7 years, the big complaint was fall invasions of homes, stink bugs coming in like Asian lady beetles. This past year or two, though, the crop damage has really picked up big time. And so, honestly, I've been referring to it as the bug from hell. And unfortunately, we had our first records of it. We had some specimens sent in September from Manitowoc, some from Dane County in September. And then this spring, I was at a conference talking to a group of pest control people, and one of them brought up evidence that they are overwintering in Madison, meaning that they have been breeding and we just haven't known it. And a bunch of them were collected on the outside of a hotel, and so they're here.
They're here.
And unfortunately, as I said, I envision this insect, it's going to take some time to build, but it's going to have a major impact. It's going to be a stinker on, as I said, fruits and vegetables, and it's also going to be a stinker because of its fall invasion.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, you know.
it's always something, isn't it? Oh, man. Well, you know, nasty bugs. Next Wednesday, April 27th, from 11:45 to 12:30, our guest will be Amy Stewart. She has a new book out. It's called Wicked Bugs, and among other things, Wicked Bugs, the Louse That Conquered Napoleon's Army and Other Diabolical Insects. That sounds like fun.
Lots of stories. Insects have had a lot of influence on history. People just sometimes don't understand that.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. That's April 27th, Wednesday, from 11:45 to 12:30. So that'll be fun. Connie in Aurora, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello. I'm calling because we have a problem with cluster flies, and especially on the south side of the house and in the garage. And they seem to be around at all times of the year. There's not in one particular time where they're absent.
Okay, well, what cluster flies are about, they're earthworm parasites by nature. So they lay their eggs and the maggots kill the earthworms. But in the fall of the year, they look for sheltered sites. And so when people talk about house flies in their house, it's usually cluster flies. And just like a lot of these fall invaders, they come in, they're in the walls, and you're bothered from the 1st of September till at least the 1st of May, just from the ones that are spending the winter. Now, I'm a little concerned about the middle of the summer because I can go find cluster flies out in marshes and whatnot if I go look for them, but they have no business being around the house in the summer. So there are other flies that look similar, but The story with cluster flies, at least as far as the house is concerned, is you can't let them get in. And it's all about drawing the line in September. And it's either physically keeping them out or spraying the outside of the structure. And it's funny because it's always the sunny areas that they congregate on. And so it's usually the south and maybe the east sides of the house that you worry about spraying before they get in. You'll see their populations ebb and flow in lush years where there's lots of worms, there's lots of cluster flies. In droughty years, we don't see near the problem because there's no worms to support their populations.
We have Janine in Green Bay with a question. Hi, Janine.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
What do I do about mealy moths?
Okay, if what you call mealy moth is the critter that I see, is probably the most common critter in the winter. It's called an Indian meal moth, and they feed on anything that's dried plant material. So you can talk about pet foods and bird seed and cereals and also raisins and nut meats. And the frustration is you bring them in on one package, and they start laying eggs, and they get into other packages. And it's kind of like a dog chasing his tail in that you've got to make sure that when you have the problem, you find all the sources and get rid of it. And then if you've got any other food around that they can get into, it's sealed in containers they can't lay eggs on. And so Tupperware, screw-top jars are all suitable. If you don't find all the sources, you never get rid of them. And sometimes it can be very frustrating. I tell the story that we brought them in on bird seed, so they're in the garage, and then they got into the kitchen and gotten the noodles and the rice, and we threw that out. And really, we had an upper hand, but we'd see a moth about once every 2 weeks, and my wife was not happy with that. And I hunted and hunted, and it wasn't the kitchen anymore, and it just was driving me crazy. And it took me, honestly, about 8 or 9 months, and I found a bag that my father-in-law had given me. It was a True Value hardware bag, but it wasn't nails. It was vegetable seeds. And those little stinkers had found the vegetable seeds, and that's where they were breeding. So I knew the source wasn't very big. But so again, so now you're starting to talk about, you know, Christmas wreaths made out of walnuts, dried flower arrangements, potpourri. I mean, anything that's dried plant material can support them, and that's what you got to do. When I pick on food, I tell people if you got a box of Bisquick, if you don't throw it out and it's got moths in it, you can spray all you want and you still got a problem. And so, as I said, this is a sanitation thing, but realize it's more than just the cereal that you've got in. It can be other things that are in the house.
Jay in Milwaukee, hello to you.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question, and I won't use any product name. I had a very small dog, a 2-3 pounder. We used a product that you put on the neck. It's a single drop, and we've used it on other pets, but this guy was very small, pretty delicate creature, and shortly after that came down with a real toxic chemical poisoning that was documented at the vet, and the vet thought it was probably that product. Have you ever heard of this before?
Oh, yeah. In fact, you find some breeds are ultra-sensitive to some of these chemicals and the like. And for that reason, you got to read the directions real closely because the companies try to keep up on this. But you got to be careful. I mean, these things are nerve poisons. And, there's sometimes a little selectivity that the insects have a different, slightly different nervous system and susceptible. But definitely these on-animal products you do have to be careful with because we do have problems with some of them.
There you go. Joe and Merrill, your turn. Hi, Joe.
Hi. The last couple of years we had this little tiny black bug that would come in. It almost looked like poppy seed on the floor. And we have hardwood floors, and they'd just be everywhere. And we kept vacuuming and vacuuming, and then we found a spot where we saw like a nest outside the house. My husband sprayed, but they kept coming. So we had an exterminator come in, and he said they were a strawberry root weevil.
Mm-hmm.
Do we need to spray again this year? We had it, and it took care of all the bugs. We live in the woods, so it's kind of buggy.
Well, the thing about strawberry root weevil, the grubs feed on the roots of various plants, and so the chance of having another invasion is pretty good. Now, they're harmless. I mean, that's the good news is they don't hurt anything, but you're going to have to keep your guard up because what you do when it is a problem, I don't spray indoors for them because that's not the source. You spray along the outside foundation, and so keep your eyes open. If they do show up, then you would do that kind of treatment again. Some years they don't show up. You know, but strawberry root weevil, it's a very interesting animal. All female population. Males are found with it. As I said, they do cause some. And it's not just strawberries. In fact, I see them more on evergreens, roots of plants. But it's always amazed me at the sheer number of adults that come in and how little plant damage we actually see. I've also seen them breed on sedum and other plants. So it's a large variety of plants will support them. And again, if you've got them breeding out in the woods, what you're seeing are the adults coming in seeking shelter. And that's what's causing the nuisance.
Phil, always a pleasure. Thanks so much. You'll come back in a month or so?
About a month.
All right. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. Thanks to Phil. Thank you for listening. Tomorrow, again, we'll talk Forest Products Lab and the state of Wisconsin's elk herd. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.